The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Well, welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. This is Shreya Gupta.
And I'm Michael Vu.
And we are continuing our landmark series in collaboration with ASO and SSO. Today's topic, we will be covering colorectal cancer. As we know that this is the third most common cancer in the United States and affecting more close to 150,000 new patients projected in 2020. As we also know that colorectal cancer is highly preventable and screening and detection has greatly improved our outcomes and early diagnosis is key to survival. To discuss and to kick off this two-part series of colorectal cancer, we have Dr. George Chang joining us. He is the Deputy Department Chair of Surgical Oncology, Section Chief of Colorectal, and a professor at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Dr. Chang did his medical school in UCLA, followed by surgical training at UCSF and colorectal fellowship training at Mayo Clinic. He's an avid researcher. His research interests are cancer treatment, outcomes research, and clinical epidemiology related to cancer treatments. He also completed his master's in clinical research in UT Houston. He has authored numerous publications in the field of colorectal cancer. We are extremely honored to have you on our podcast to discuss this landmark series on rectal cancer. Dr. Chang, welcome on Behind the Knife.
Thanks very much. It's really my pleasure to be here.
So before we delve into this topic, I wanted to talk about the recent death of a very beloved actor, Chadwick Boseman. You recently talked about colorectal cancer in an opinion that you wrote in Houston Chronicle. Tell us a little bit about your article.
Well, the death of Chadwick Boseman at such a young age, 43, was a deep and poignant loss. But his death from colorectal cancer really brings attention to the alarming rise in the incidence of colorectal cancer in young adults and the rate at which young adults and Black Americans in particular are dying from colorectal cancer. Black colorectal cancer patients are more likely to be diagnosed with more advanced disease and have worse survival outcomes. We wrote this op-ed to highlight this issue. And in that op-ed, I described the results of the Delaware Cancer Treatment Program, which many people may be familiar, but there clearly is greater opportunity to share this experience. This was established by the state legislatures as an aggressive stance on curbing the growing disparities in colorectal cancer survival. This really took legislative will. Special programs were enacted to reach the Black community, including local efforts pairing nurse navigators with community organizations and targeted educational outreach. Combined, these programs gave every Delaware citizen universal colorectal cancer coverage. In the first 5 years of this program, colorectal cancer screenings increased 25% among Black people in Delaware, rising to mirror the white population. And among Black patients, rates of diagnosis at advanced stages were slashed nearly in half. And importantly, incidence and mortality rates soon equalized. The success of this program really highlights one potential prescription to reduce colorectal cancer disparities, and that is to improve screening rates, ensure equal access to quality care, and to eliminate systemic racism. That was the point we wanted to make in this opinion piece.
That's amazing. It's very nice to see surgeons leading this campaign. I think that we are at the forefront of really increasing and improving outcomes related to this preventable cancer. And this is such a great discussion, such a great opinion that was in Houston Chronicle. I invite everyone to read this, and thank you for sharing that on our podcast. So the topic for the discussion today will be the management of the lateral lymph nodes in rectal cancer. So just to set the background for our listeners, there are currently two schools of thought. On the West, the circumferential resection margin has been the main focus and predictor of overall survival with treatment of lateral nodes with chemoradiation. However, on the East, the lateral lymph nodes are treated as part of the local regional disease and hence treated with surgical resection without neoadjuvant therapy. However, the jury is still out on which approach is superior or adequate. And today, with the help of our expert, Dr. Chang, we'll address the landmark papers discussing this topic. So without further ado, let's begin our discussion. So the first landmark paper we are going to discuss today is the JCOG-0212 trial, also called the TME surgery with or without lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. So Dr. Chang, could you briefly talk about the aims of the JCOG-0212 trial?
Sure. As you've alluded to, I think this discussion really has to begin with the evolution of rectal cancer treatment in the West compared to the evolution of rectal cancer treatment primarily in Japan. In the West, we recognize that the outcomes following surgery for rectal cancer were suboptimal. Local recurrence rates were unacceptably high. This led to the introduction of the use of radiation therapy in combination with surgery to help improve the outcomes of surgery in rectal cancer. What this resulted in is a reduction in the rate of local recurrence, about 50%, relatively speaking, compared to surgery alone. We have since seen the evolution of surgical treatment, including with the promotion and advancement of optimal surgical technique, so-called TME surgery. And this has led to improvements in outcome as well. One of the things that we've recognized during the development of TME surgery is that the resection margin, what we call the circumferential resection margin, is one of the critical, critically important endpoints or outcomes of surgery that determines local control. That is, those patients in whom surgery is associated with a positive circumferential resection margin will have a much higher risk for local failure with or without radiation therapy. While this kind of evolution was occurring in the West, in the East, there was a general recognition that lymph node disease was a major contributor to recurrence. And therefore, surgery was focused on ensuring complete resection, including of the lymph node basin. Of course, in low rectal cancer, the drainage pattern occurs both centrally and in an ascending fashion, that is along the superior rectal vessels, but also laterally along the internal iliac and obturator chain. And so that's how the field of rectal cancer surgery has separately evolved in the West to include chemoradiation therapy or radiation therapy, along with an attention to that circumferential resection margin. And then in the East, really attention to completeness of surgery that does also include that resection margin, but also surgical management of the lateral pelvic nodal basin. So the approach in Japan is prophylactic dissection of the lateral compartment, much in the way that we consider prophylactic, if you will, radiation of the lateral compartment to eliminate micrometastatic disease. So the treatment standard in Japan, unlike in the West, is total mesorectal excision and lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. So JACOG 0212 was a non-inferiority trial that aimed to compare the standard of care, which is total mesorectal excision and lateral pelvic lymph node dissection, to the experimental arm, which is total mesorectal excision alone. This is a bit of an unusual concept for surgeons in the West because we think of total mesorectal excision alone as being the standard of care. And so, JACOG 0212 actually viewed the total mesorectal excision alone as the experimental arm and asked if that was non-inferior to total mesorectal excision with lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. What the investigators found was that they could not demonstrate non-inferiority of total mesorectal excision alone. In fact, in the total mesorectal excision without lateral pelvic lymph node dissection arm, there was a significantly higher rate of local failure. It was 13% compared to 7% in the total mesorectal excision plus lateral pelvic lymph node dissection arm. If you think about some of the outcomes that we see in the radiation trials, you can see that this is quite analogous to the local recurrence rates associated with radiation and surgery versus surgery alone. It should be noted, though, in JACOG 0212, those patients who had clinical evidence of lateral pelvic metastasis, that is clinical evidence of metastasis within the internal iliac or obturator basins, those patients were excluded. In other words, it only included those patients in whom they felt that there was no clinical evidence of disease within that compartment.
And Dr. Chang, in your paper, you then compare the results of JACOG 0212 to the Dutch trial. What can you explain the Dutch trial and how do those two experiments differ, and how do we synthesize their results in our understanding of what the optimal management of those lymph nodes is?
Right. So I was alluding to this in my earlier comments. So the Dutch TME trial is a landmark study that all students of rectal cancer should be familiar. It was the very first study with surgical quality control or surgical quality assurance, that is, in efforts to ensure that the quality of surgery was confirmed. There was a training program and monitoring to ensure that total mesorectal excision was performed. And the experimental arm in that study was radiation plus surgery. So unlike the JACOG 0212 study, the control arm here was surgery alone. And the experimental arm was radiation followed by surgery. This is an older study, and surgical technique has since improved. But what this study demonstrated was that radiation plus surgery was superior to surgery alone, particularly with respect to local control. Neither of these studies demonstrated overall survival improvements, but that is a little bit more of a complicated issue. And I think it's, for the purposes of this discussion, focusing on local control is relevant. Local control is a major problem, obviously, in rectal cancer.
So it sounds like we've got, you know, these two candidates for improving that local regional control, surgical versus radiation or chemoradiation. Do we have data that help us distinguish perhaps which one of these is a superior approach? How good is our data in this question?
That obviously is the question that people always want to know. And unfortunately, as you can imagine, it's pretty difficult to do a head-to-head study like that. So there is no randomized trial comparing surgery plus radiation to surgery plus lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. And the reason for that is that the evolution, as we've discussed, has really followed these geographic lines. you know, in the West, we couldn't conduct a randomized trial because there's insufficient expertise in lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. And in the East, there is a significant bias against radiotherapy, and therefore it would be difficult to conduct that trial as well. As it turns out, there's increasing use of radiation therapy, even in Japan, as there has been more recently much more attention that has come to the role of lateral pelvic lymph node dissection, even in the setting of radiotherapy in the West. So we are fortunately at a time when we are seeing a bit of a convergence of the management strategies. And we can talk more about why this is relevant. But I think what the data has shown is that whether we're comparing surgery alone to radiation plus surgery, or surgery plus lateral pelvic lymph node dissection to just central surgery, we're seeing that there is a similar benefit with respect to local control. What that means is that the prophylactic approach to unresected, in the case of the West, lateral compartment, micrometastatic disease, or that the prophylactic management of micrometastasis within the lateral compartment, either through radiotherapy or through prophylactic surgery, seems to achieve a similar outcome. One thing that these data show us is insufficient is simply central compartment surgery alone.
For our young listeners, let's take a step back here, and could you for us explain what exactly a lateral pelvic lymph node dissection involves, and maybe comment on the morbidity of this seizure, or perhaps even some of the surgical aspects as far as increasing the time of the operation, comment on the blood loss, or you know, things that a surgeon needs to think about when trying to incorporate into this practice?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And one of the reasons why there has been this ongoing debate, there in general, our surgical training has very limited opportunity to gain experience in dissection and in the lateral compartment. What we mean by the lateral compartment are the lymph nodes along the internal iliac artery, as well as within the obturator space. And the boundaries of this dissection include the obturator internus muscle laterally, the external iliac anteriorly, the bladder distally, and the sacral nerve roots posteriorly. This is kind of a difficult area in which to work because there are so many vessels and so many critical structures. So one of the reasons why this debate has persisted is also because the body habitus of Western patients is different than those in the East. In other words, it's much more difficult. This is a challenging operation, much more difficult to perform in, or it's perceived to be much more difficult to perform in Western patients. And clearly, you know, the more obesity we have, the more difficult it is to perform. But it's now been well demonstrated, and we and others have shown that you can do this safely and effectively. Historically, this has been associated with significant blood loss, but now we see that this can be achieved even in a minimally invasive fashion with minimal blood loss. Historically, this was associated with significant autonomic dysfunction because it involved, in its initial evolution, it also included resection of some of the nerves and disruption of the autonomic nerves. But now with advances in technique, we can see that there's much more preservation that can be achieved, and so we can preserve autonomic function as well. And so the morbidity actually with proper technique, the morbidity actually is not that high. And in fact, we see that in the JCOG 0212 study, that there really was not a significant increase in morbidity in the control arm compared to the experimental arm. There was, however, longer operative time and greater blood loss. The other aspect of this, as we think about this, particularly in the West, is that there are concepts of prophylactic lymph node dissection and therapeutic lymph node dissection. So in prophylactic lymph node dissection, as was performed in 0212, both sides would have to be dissected, which puts the autonomic nerves at both sides at risk. But in the event, in the case of therapeutic dissection, which is the approach that we would advocate in our program, then bilateral dissection is only performed when there's clinical evidence of disease. And so we now can take an approach that combines these strategies to minimize morbidity.
So coming back to the paper, we talk about how lateral pelvic lymph nodes are categorized. And there was a school of thought that whether these are local regional disease or should be characterized as metastatic disease. Can you comment on that?
So the drainage pattern of or the drainage pathways of the rectum include the superior hemorrhoidal vessel, vascular drainage, obviously, so that's the central drainage, but it also includes drainage through the internal iliac system. And so these would be considered regional lymph node metastases. Historically, in the West, we had considered this area because it was not, I think because it was not a part of the anatomy that was included with surgery, would consider this to be more distant metastasis. And I think the way to think about it is we can look at survival based on presence of lymph node metastasis. And this was well demonstrated within pool data from the Japanese. We can see, we can see that survival outcomes for those patients with lymph node metastasis within the mesorectum is better than survival for those patients with lymph node metastasis in the lateral compartment. However, those patients still do better than those who have disease at distant sites. So clear evidence of distant metastatic disease. So based on that, we can see that their outcomes are already better than those with distant metastasis. And so we can consider the lateral compartment to be regional. According to the AJCC, we consider internal iliac lymph node metastasis to be regional and obturator lymph node metastases to be distant, along with external iliac lymph node metastasis. This is a bit of an artificial delineation because it's very difficult actually to delineate whether something is internal iliac or obturator. It's not like there's a clear boundary that says, you know, one or the other. And we can see that patients, and the obturator area is actually a common area for metastasis. And we see that those patients, their survival is actually more aligned with those with internal iliac metastasis, as opposed to external iliac disease, which is the next level. In other words, it's sort of the next region beyond the initial distribution. So I would advocate that we consider internal iliac and obturator lymph node metastases to be regional, and therefore we should manage them as we do regional disease. One of the things that comes up a lot in this discussion is that if it's metastatic disease, then they need a systemic treatment for them and not a surgical approach. And that it is true that when patients have systemic disease, we should treat them in a systemic fashion. But much in the same way that we direct that we manage patients with distant metastasis, such as liver metastasis or lung metastases or metastases to the ovary with surgery and can achieve cure, in combination, of course, with multidisciplinary treatment, this is the same approach that we should take in the lateral compartment as well.
Along the same lines, can you comment on the introduction? I know you touched on minimally invasive techniques, but specifically use of the robots for these deeper pelvic resections and dissections. Can you comment on the utility of that and how that has changed the landscape of doing lateral pelvic lymph node dissections?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. We still don't have widespread availability of lateral pelvic lymph node surgical technique in the United States, or in the West, actually, for that matter. We have certainly seen that there's a lot more interest, and we have certainly utilized that of utilizing the surgical robot to facilitate this dissection. In the East, there have been many successful reports, and in fact, it's fairly commonplace for a laparoscopic lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. Laparoscopic pelvic surgery, particularly in Western patients, is very difficult, no matter what we're doing, whether it be simply rectal resection or particularly when we're talking about lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. So the robot has really facilitated our ability to do that. It is the superior optics, the added instrumentation, the greater dexterity, et cetera. All of those things that we talk about that where the robot can make difficult surgery easier. This is an example of where the robot makes difficult surgery easier. You guys might want to take a peek at, so we just published, in fact, I think it just went into press this week, our robotic lateral pelvic lymph node dissection experience in colorectal disease. And so you might want to take a look if you might find that helpful.
Oh, that's a wonderful suggestion. We'll be sure to put it in the show notes. So all you listeners can definitely find the paper in that little section. So I wanted to go back to chemoradiotherapy for those lymph nodes. There's a section in your paper titled "Chemoradiotherapy Alone Is Not Sufficient," and you mentioned recent evidence suggesting that neoadjuvant therapy is not sufficient alone to prevent recurrence in the lateral compartment. Can you tell us about that evidence base and what you think that means for our practice?
So I think this gets back to this concept of treatment intent. And I think this is a really critical issue as we think about lateral pelvic lymph node metastases. Are we treating with prophylactic intent? In other words, are we taking a patient who has no clinical evidence of disease and addressing the potential for micrometastasis? That's what we're doing with chemoradiation therapy, and that's what the Japanese are doing with lateral pelvic lymph node dissection in the majority of cases. But there are many patients who also present with clinical evidence of disease. They have pathologic lymph nodes within that lateral compartment. These are lymph nodes that would not normally be included in the standard surgical resection, in the TME surgery. And unfortunately, far too often in the West, these patients are dismissed or can be dismissed as having metastatic disease and are not offered an opportunity for curative treatment. Or we treat them with chemoradiation with kind of the hopes that we're going to sterilize that compartment. What we have seen is that as the central surgery has improved, as we've done better with surgery for rectal cancer, we are seeing less of an influence of recurrences, what we call central recurrences, those that are happening along the anastomosis or within the unresected residual mesorectum. But we are seeing more of the recurrences occurring in the lateral compartment. When we go back to look at the imaging and the workup on these patients, some of the best data for this actually comes from Korea, where they were early adopters of chemoradiation therapy and more recently have become adopters of the combined approach in the appropriate setting. But we see that those patients who have abnormal lymph nodes in that lateral compartment are at a much higher risk of developing local recurrence. In fact, in centers with good central surgery, more than two-thirds of local recurrences when they occur were identified in the lateral compartment. And if we look at the lymph nodes in that lateral compartment, if we use size as one criteria, size is not the perfect criteria, but it is one criterion that we can use. If we have lymph nodes that are 10 millimeters or more in that lateral compartment, the rate of local recurrence or lateral local failure is as high as 30% or more. And we've seen this actually confirmed in additional data that's come from Oxford, in the UK. So as our imaging has improved, we're now much better able to identify patients who are at risk for disease within that lateral compartment. And radiation alone for these patients is inadequate because we are observing local failures. And these local failures are occurring in the lateral compartment. These lateral compartment local failures are extremely hard to treat. They often require resection of the pelvic sidewall to adequately manage them, which is a pretty significant operation which carries morbidity as well. Now, conversely, in the East, the approach, as we discussed, has been surgery. And we see that those patients, so we've already talked about prophylactic intent. What about therapeutic intent? So those patients have clinical evidence of disease. When we look at the data that comes from Japan from centers that have been very, very strong proponents of the radicality of surgery and opponents of radiotherapy, we can see that among those patients who undergo lateral pelvic lymph node dissection and have a positive lymph node identified, those patients also have a similarly high rate of local failure. What we are seeing is that we can address micrometastatic disease perhaps with the radiotherapy, but when there's clear evidence of disease, clinically within those lymph nodes, the radiotherapy seems to be inadequate. And while we can address some of this disease surgically, there are still the microscopic disease deposits or the spread that can come through those lymphatics that are unresected, right? Since we're not resecting that whole space or dissecting those lymph nodes, so that are unresected, that those then become the source of recurrence. And so what we talk about in this landmark series is that we now have come to the understanding, and this is an approach that we've taken for many years, we've now come to the understanding for those patients in whom we take a therapeutic intent, those patients who have clinical evidence of lateral pelvic lymph node metastasis, then we can achieve optimal pelvic disease control by the combination, and only by the combination, of chemoradiation and surgery, that is chemoradiation and lateral pelvic lymph node dissection. In fact, when we take that approach, we have demonstrated that we don't develop local recurrences. And I think that's the critical point that we were trying to make. And it really demonstrates the evolution of rectal cancer treatment. And we're seeing a convergence of the philosophies of the East and the West, if you will, which is great, actually. We can only learn from each other rather than trying to keep ourselves to our silos. Progress happens when we learn from each other. And I think that this is a great example of how that has happened. And now you've seen the literature a lot more interest in understanding the optimal management of this disease. And there's great interest in the West of the surgical approach. And there is increasing utilization in the East of radiotherapy in addition to lateral pelvic lymph node dissection.
So based on the current literature, can you talk to us, who are the candidates that would best benefit from neoadjuvant chemo radiotherapy? And the second part to that question for me would be, what are some of the quote-unquote side effects of neoadjuvant chemo radiotherapy and the challenges that it can produce or one should expect when these patients do undergo resections, including lateral pelvic lymph node dissections?
That has been a point of discussion for many, many years in the West, and we've moved well beyond that now. That is to say, there was a lot of concern in the U.S. The evolution, we kind of simplified that evolution in our earlier discussion, was the addition of radiotherapy came initially after surgery, not before surgery. Although we all recognize now the superiority of preoperative to postoperative treatment. And the reason that postoperative treatment remained a treatment standard in the US for so long is because of this concern that surgery would be more difficult after radiation therapy. And the same comments are made about surgery in the lateral compartment, that it would be more difficult after radiation therapy. And I would say we have learned how to operate after radiation. And in that initial treatment phase, that is, we're not talking about 2-3 years later, we're talking about, you know, within the first year after radiotherapy, we can successfully perform surgery safely without significant risk for added morbidity because we gave radiotherapy. We need not be concerned about the addition of radiation these days. I would say also the techniques have improved for radiation as well. What we really need to be concerned about is optimal treatment. But I would also add that when we see patients who have evidence for lateral pelvic lymph node metastasis, so what are the indications of that? Well, there is some debate, but it appears that lymph node size is a predictor. So we would say 7 millimeters or greater would be clinical evidence of disease. Also, there are certain patterns on MRI. So everyone needs a high quality rectal MRI. This is not a standard pelvic MRI. This is a dedicated rectal cancer MRI. And still in the US, we are working on improving making high quality MRI more broadly available because there's tremendous variation in the quality of MR imaging. But there are certain patterns that we can see, heterogeneity of the lymph nodes, spiculation, et cetera, that indicate that there is high risk for those to be metastatic. As we've already discussed, these are patients who not only have increased risk of local failure, but also have increased risk of distant failure. So these are the patients in whom we want to intensify our preoperative treatment. And increasingly, we're seeing that we're utilizing a strategy where we give not only radiotherapy, but additional chemotherapy prior to surgery in those patients. Some of these patients will achieve, just like we can in the rectum itself, sterilization of these lymph nodes after radiation therapy. And so it's important for us to also reevaluate these patients after they have completed their preoperative treatment. That is, after they've completed radiation and have had an opportunity to respond to that treatment. And what we and others have shown is that when these lymph nodes become smaller, they regress. When they become 4 millimeters or less, or less than 5 millimeters, we have not observed them to be persistently positive. Now, this requires obviously a little bit more validation. This is, there remains some controversy as to the value of that post-treatment imaging, but certainly the experience that we have demonstrated, and we and others have demonstrated, and what's reflected in our experience is that when these lymph nodes respond, that they get smaller, when the signal intensity evolves so that they no longer have some of those high-risk characteristics, we've not found them on final pathologic evaluation to have persistent metastatic deposits in them. Now, I think that this is an area we need to continue to investigate. That is, if a patient has clinical evidence of disease and there's been treatment response, do they still need dissection or not? And so that is something that we're still learning about. But hopefully that answers your question about how do we decide who should get these treatments and how do we decide who should get both radiation and surgery or radiation alone. And I will add then, if you were to take an Eastern perspective to this, as we've already shown from JCOG-0212, that a prophylactic treatment, an appropriate prophylactic treatment is TME surgery plus lateral pelvic lymph node dissection, you could make the argument there then it's appropriate without evidence, clinical evidence of disease to do that, to operate with lateral pelvic lymph node dissection and not incorporate radiation at all. But as we've also discussed, when there's clinical evidence of disease, even if you were to take that approach, which is that the standard treatment is surgery plus lateral pelvic, is TME surgery plus lateral pelvic lymph node dissection, just as we would add lateral pelvic lymph node dissection to our chemoradiation approach, they would add or should add chemoradiation to the lateral pelvic lymph node dissection approach.
That makes a lot of sense. And I can already see this landmark series being continued and kind of taking the path that esophageal cancer has taken, which is, you know, after you do see a response in the lateral lymph nodes, go forward with the lateral pelvic lymph node dissection or not? Do you wait and watch? You know, like the controversies that have come up in the rectal cancer. So I think there's definitely more to come and more to learn as this evolves even further. So I actually had a kind of off topic follow-up question in regards to people who do undergo or should undergo neoadjuvant radiotherapy. How do you take a patient that has a low rectal cancer that's perhaps obstructing or obstruction, causing obstructive symptoms, and how do you justify giving radiotherapy when, you know, considering that they might get, you know, fully obstructed?
Yeah, that is obviously an important clinical decision-making point for those patients. I think we have to always step back and think, what is the optimal treatment for this patient? If this patient were not obstructing, what would we want to do? Would surgery upfront be adequate treatment for this patient or not? And I think the answer to that question in the scenario you described is that it would not be, right? Optimal treatment in that patient includes multimodality care. That is, you know, whether it includes additional systemic chemotherapy or not, that patient needs preoperative radiation therapy. Well, it's pretty simple to resolve this issue for low rectal cancer. The patient simply needs to be diverted first. So you leave the tumor intact, divert the patient so that you no longer have this concern of obstruction, and then go ahead and treat that patient. Those patients in whom you still have a significant lumen available, then obviously that would not be necessary. But this is certainly an approach that we utilize not uncommonly for those patients who present late in their disease course.
Excellent. I think in order to wrap up this really great discussion, could you talk to us about your practice at MD Anderson and the current state and recommendations for based on the studies that we have discussed in our episode today?
So unfortunately, we do see a lot of patients who have locally advanced disease, those with a number of features that we haven't even talked about on this podcast, but high risk features that we can identify by MRI, and lateral pelvic lymph node metastasis is but one of them. So all of our patients will undergo direct evaluation by the surgeon. That includes direct endoscopic evaluation. I think that's critical. They will all undergo multidisciplinary review, where we have a team of dedicated radiologists who have expertise in rectal MR imaging, as well as our GI radiation oncologists with an interest in rectal cancer, and the medical oncologists as well. And so multidisciplinary evaluation is key. And I would advocate that in any circumstance is that we want detailed information. So you want complete initial evaluation. It has to be high quality data with which we are working. And then multidisciplinary discussion in order to develop the optimal treatment approach. I think we've alluded to kind of the different strategies that we've utilized, you know, in patients who have this kind of aggressive disease. Clearly, those patients who have lateral pelvic lymph node metastasis fall into a higher risk group. We've talked about that already, right? They are much higher, they're at a much higher risk, not only for local failure, but for distant metastases as well. So we want to optimize their treatment. And we know that optimizing their treatment before surgery is much more likely to be successful, that the treatment completion rates are higher, that toxicity is lower. And so we take that approach. So we all patients undergo multidisciplinary evaluation, and then we come up with a treatment plan that's appropriate for that patient. That also means that those patients who have lower risk disease, they don't need all of that intensive treatment. There are some patients who would not even need radiotherapy, depending on their disease. And so that's why it's so critically important that we have high quality data that we can use. That is, in particularly for rectal cancer, it's high quality rectal MRI imaging. It's important, since you will have a bunch of colleagues and trainees who will be listening to this podcast, it's important for all surgeons to become familiar with imaging modalities and become familiar at how to not only about how to use them, but how to interpret those images. And that's something that will come with additional experience, but also is facilitated by having this regular interchange and dialogue with our multidisciplinary colleagues.
Well, this has really been a wonderful discussion, Dr. Chang. Thanks for coming on and talking with us about it. Really appreciate it. Any last words before we let you go?
Well, I just want to congratulate you guys on this podcast series. I think it's terrific that you're doing this, and I'm sure that many people benefit from listening to them. It's terrific that you've partnered with the Annals of Surgical Oncology and the SSO. These are really important topics, and they're really actually cutting edge topics, in fact. So hopefully this will be something useful for all of your listeners. And I really wish you all luck in your careers.
Until next time, dominate the day.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.